Listen to me. I never gave Russell any money. Do you understand? The way I remember, it was your plan all along. You and Jimmy, you had this crazy fixation about me, and you were getting some kind of perverted kick out of the whole idea, like people with your sexual problems tend to do. And Russell went along with you because Russell is basically an evil little fucking scumbag. Well, I'll bet you're having some kind of sick, dirty sex with inspired your lesbian tendencies, huh?
Wait a minute! Wait a minute! I thought we were friends!
Well, okay. Can you take some advice from a friend? You keep your fucking mouth shut.
A modern day remake of Matthew Vaughn's Leia kick, a Coen brothers end up with Timothy Chalamet.
A Citizen Kane prequel, a Midnight Cowboy sequel, Alvin and the Chipmunks deserve another squeak.
There's so many new ways to revisit sideways, but a graphic novel is how we choose to update.
But we still hold fast, you can't change the past on the Ruined Childhoods podcast.
Greetings, starfighters, mothers of rivers, and old men on the mountain. This is Ruined Childhoods, and on this episode, we are back in New England in the Granite State, the first of the states alphabetically to begin with the word new. This state is the birthplace of Spaceman Alan Shepard, star of Spaceman Adam Sandler, and Space Jam A New Legacy actor Sarah Silverman. In this state, it's illegal to tap your feet to the music in a bar, catch a matinee before 2 p.m., or urinate while looking up on a Sunday. And although it is not an enforceable law, failing to live free will result in the death penalty. That's right, this week we're in New Hampshire, home to fictional town of Little Hope, where our movie of the week takes place. Dan, call me crazy today, but I prefer Hampshire Classic. How about you?
I like Crystal Hampshire.
I don't disagree.
Spiced
it
Hampshire.
Came back for a little bit. Yeah, that's all the rage now.
And yes, I know. I'm mixing my Pepsi and Coke references. I'm aware of what I'm doing.
Well, at least you're not referencing the Uncola 7-Up.
Oh, I dare not speak its name.
No, we will not make 7-Up yours. So Dan,
not today, not ever. Yes.
Have you ever been in New Hampshire?
I have been to New Hampshire. I attended the wedding of my very good friend Michael Doobie in New Hampshire.
Oh, in New Hampshire.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Yes, he is a Hampshirean. I've just made that up. He lives in New Hampshire.
Oh, he lives there?
Yes. Oh. Both he and his wife are both professors at the University of New Hampshire.
Oh, no way. He probably came up when we did our Jim Steinman episode.
Oh, without a doubt. Yes. But yeah, so I'm trying to remember if I've been to New Hampshire for other reasons than attending his wedding, but that's really what I remember. What about you, John? What's your experience with New Hampshire?
Well, I definitely was in New Hampshire when I was a high school senior and like going around to different colleges to kind of check them out. There was, I think it was Keene College in Keene, New Hampshire, I checked out. And I definitely have been through there. I think that when I was going to school in Hartford, Connecticut, and I think that when I took a bus up to visit friends in Vermont, I think we might have gone through New Hampshire, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, if I remember correctly, it's a lovely state. It's
classic New England. It is.
Classic New England, yeah.
Yeah. With a little bit of a flair for, as you alluded to, the independence and, in New England, it is more of a Republican state in more so in limiting the reach of big government. People in New Hampshire like to live in New Hampshire. And
it is a more libertarian.
Yes.
If you had to describe it.
Yes,
more politically.
That would be the better word to use to describe it. Yes. Yeah. So they are, but yeah, that's
yeah.
They, and they, also, they live free or die. hard.
Yeah, and of course, New Hampshire is responsible for giving us the title for the fourth installment of the Die Hard franchise, which we have covered on this podcast, Live Free or Die Hard. Yes.
But only the fourth installment, so.
That was in our May the 4th series of fourth installments. It was the month of May, I think, our first year of doing the podcast.
What a fabulous theme month that was.
We did Citizens on Patrol.
That we did.
Rocky IV.
Oh, yes.
Live Free or Die Hard.
Pre-director's cut.
Well, right, but we came back after we did our 200th episode, we revisited that one as well as some of the other ones where there had been new installments since we had recorded. I can't remember what other fourth installment of a movie we did.
It was Police Academy, Die Hard, Rocky. I was expecting the fourth one to just like I'm like, it's just gonna happen. It's just gonna roll off. It wasn't Indiana Jones, was it?
It was Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
I was thinking, wait a second, we did the whole Indiana Jones franchise.
Yeah, we did an episode of just Indiana Jones movies. So I guess it wasn't Crystal Skull that we did.
No, it was not. We'll look back. It'll come to us.
Whatever.
All right, what else has a part four? We didn't do, I don't think we did any horror movies. So it wouldn't have been a Friday the 13th or a Nightmare on Elm Street.
No.
It was not Star Trek IV.
No.
The Voyage Home.
Was it Superman IV, Quest for Peace.
It sadly was not.
I bet that we discussed doing that one. We had to have, right?
We must have discussed doing that one and perhaps saved it for a special Superman episode, which has yet to come to pass. So... there was a fourth. It is now driving me crazy.
Let's move on from that, because before we get to our like movie of the week, I do want to talk about as I mentioned in the intro, New Hampshire is the birthplace of Adam Sandler, and and a lot of his movies do take place in New Hampshire. Eight Crazy Nights, Mr. Deeds, that era. I think the Grown Ups movies might take place in New Hampshire, but
that's entirely possible.
Yeah, but I recently watched Happy Gilmore for the first time in a long time, and man, what a great movie!
That's New Hampshire, isn't it?
Is it New Hampshire? I figured it must be New England. I don't know if they call out New Hampshire at all, but they do reference being in Portland, and I believe that they are referencing Portland, Maine.
Oh, okay.
As the all Portland right. that they are referring to.
All right. Yeah, that makes sense. But that's a fun movie, Happy Gilmore.
Oh, it's great. And
been getting some press lately.
Is beginning suppressed lately? Oh yeah, another Happy Gilmore.
Little slip about a little sequel.
Well, I've said this many times. I don't know if I've said it on the podcast, but perhaps the greatest villain in cinematic history is Shooter McGavin.
Wow. Yeah. So it's hard to argue with that, man.
He's just the best.
Like you for breakfast.
we could talk about that all day.
I love that
it's
movie.
So
okay.
Good.
All right. Okay. But we're going to talk about To Die For, and we're going to do that in a minute. And we're not. And no, that is not the four that we're looking for.
No.
I mean, To Die 1, 2, and 3 were okay, but 4 was where it really hit its stride.
Yeah, I don't even think. I think that this was even past Gus Van Sant's fourth movie. Maybe feature Mala Noche, Drugstore Cowboy, My Own Private Idaho. Was there anything else that I'm missing before this one?
I believe so. Was even Cowgirls Get the Blues? Am I making that up?
It's hard to remember all of them because Gus Van Sant has made so many movies, and you look back and you then remember like, oh yeah, that's right. He did do Elephant. Kurt Cobain one. You know,
so many that are under the radar.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in terms of, yeah, so no, even Cowgirls Get the Blues. He did a lot of music videos.
He did do a lot of music videos.
Yeah. So yeah, Mala Noche in 86 and then Drugstore Cowboy in 89, My Own Private Idaho in 91. I went right back. Even Cowgirls Get the Blues in 93 and then To Die For in 95.
Oh, okay. So this is the fifth feature from Gus Van Sant. So close enough.
Yes. Yes, it's I feel like it should have like the Quentin Tarantino, the ninth feature from Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, right. Do you have a favorite Gus Van Sant movie? Are you a big Gus Van Sant head?
I mean, I like a big Gus Van Sant head. I would say no, just because I haven't seen a lot of the films. Like I haven't seen Elephant. I saw a little bit of the Kurt Cobain one. Right. And oh, did he direct The Sea of Trees? Oh, I thought that was...
No. Did he?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he did? I don't know why. Okay. I thought that was like Terrence Malick, but oh, I saw that. I didn't see that, but there were a few that I definitely... Oh, Milk. I saw Milk.
I think you're thinking of Tree of Life for Terrence Malick.
Well, no. There was another Terrence Malick, To the Wonder is the one that I'm thinking of.
You said Milk, yeah.
Yeah, Milk. So it's a tough call. Of course, Good Will Hunting. He directed Finding Forrester. I never saw that, but...
Y'all the man now, dog. Yeah. That's all I know it for.
Yeah, I think everybody knows that line and nothing else about that movie. So favorite Gus Van Sant movie? Ooh, I might have to say I think it might be To Die For. What's your favorite?
I don't necessarily disagree. A Good Will Hunting is so good. I mean, that movie gets you right in the heart big time. It's
and
so
how do
good.
You like them apples? Another iconic line.
Well, that movie, I mean, yeah, son of a bitch, you stole my line. I mean, there's so many great lines in that movie.
Gonna see about a girl.
Yeah, I watched that one also recently, and it's great every single time. It's perfect. I also watched Drugstore Cowboy the other day.
I haven't seen that.
Because that was kind of... That was a blind spot for me.
That could potentially be a favorite. I haven't seen it in such a long time.
It's so good. It is definitely, I'd say, ahead of its time. And one thing that I will say about Gus Van Sant is that, like, you know, say what you will about some of his more questionable choices, like the Psycho remake, but like he takes big swings and sometimes they pay off, sometimes they don't. And I feel like even doing To Die For, coming off of like these indie hits, was such like a, you know, a bold move. He's teaming up with Nicole Kidman in her first like real starring role. And I gotta say, like, it could have really not worked if it was with other people.
No. We'll get into it. And he, you know, he's working with some known entities for himself here, notably reuniting with Matt Dillon from Drugstore Cowboy. But I totally lost. I had a thought and it escaped me. But coming back to Gus Van. Oh yeah, so the Gus Van Sant is kind of one of those, like, you hear about. You know, we think a lot about the directors who it's kind of like a, you know, one for them, one for me, like the Soderberghs of the world. And I feel like Gus Van Sant is like the five for me, one for them. And even then, it's like the ones, but even when you think about his, like, the bigger, the higher profile movies, like Psycho and Finding Forrester, they're not the ones that stand out in his filmography. And I would consider those to be, so even though To Die For is a studio film and it has a higher profile, it still very much has that indie spirit to it.
Sure. Should we do a synopsis? I have just a very quick, like, one sentence synopsis for this one.
Let's go.
All right, this is going to be a quick one, so don't get too comfortable or anything. A New Hampshire woman finds that married life and the pressures of starting a family is getting in the way of her dreams of becoming a famous television personality. So she uses her charm and sexuality to groom a trio of burnout high schoolers into becoming junior assassins. I mean, what more do you need to say?
No, that pretty much captures it.
It captures it, but this...
It captures the plot.
It captures the plot, but it's like, this movie is not necessarily built around the plot itself, but the characters and the performances and the beautiful cinematic risks that are taken to achieve it. Nicole Kidman Suzanne Stone, absolutely incredible. Like we were saying before, it's like her first starring role. And, she wasn't like proven. This is definitely against type for what she had been doing up to this. And
she'd been romantic. I'm like, what had she done before this? A lot. I mean, primarily like romantic leads opposite Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Thinking of Days of Thunder. Get back in the car, Cole. Let me out of the car, Cole. my favorite
far
line.
Far and away.
From that one, Far and Away. Yeah.
Yeah.
And she had done like other, like some Australian films, Dead Calm.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is really the first movie that she's carrying where it's her name and only her name above the title. The poster is her. And so much of the movie is that close up shot of her talking directly into the camera, which is a bold move.
And I love the way this movie is structured because, yes, it's like a dark comedy, but it also is kind of, it's got the documentary style to it. And the movie was written by Buck Henry and, based off of a novel that was based off a true story of a woman, I believe a teacher, actually.
Pamela Smart.
Who was involved with a student and got him to kill her husband. I believe she is still in prison. And I was listening to, because Criterion just released this on 4K Blu-ray, and there was a new commentary track with Gus Van Sant, also the editor and the cinematographer. And...
Wow.
One of the things that they were it's a really great commentary track.
Among others, those are definitely people I would want to hear from about this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And what they were saying is that in the way that the script is written, and Buck Henry is very particular about his scripts and wants them to be done the way that he has written them. And they initially cut this in a more linear way. And it just wasn't feeling right. And so they, mixed things around and they did it the way they did it. And I feel like that's the right move. And that's a big swing and it totally makes it pop. And it's just so riveting every moment of this.
Well, because otherwise the story, when you look at the plot alone, it's a, kind of pretty basic film noir plot.
I said it all in one sentence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of somebody manipulating somebody else to murder another person.
Yeah.
A spouse. This is, we've seen it. We referenced Strangers on a Train when we talked about Throw Mama from the Train, but kind of a, similar concept there. No names are coming to mind, but I'm thinking of a lot of those old like Humphrey Bogart mysteries and like a Double Indemnity type thing, which I know Humphrey Bogart was not in. That's Fred McMurray.
Yeah.
Robert Stanwyck. But like that type of thing. But then when you take it and the commentary on the media in it really is driven home by, like you said, this mixture of media styles. Like we have the documentary, we have there's the documentary format, there's the talk show format that the parents and
the
siblings,
one sister,
are on the talk show, and then there's the kind of self-taped There's the self-taped that she that
well,
you that
that's
you,
well, spoiler alert, yeah.
Spoiler alert from, you know, a quarter century ago, more than a quarter.
Sure.
Almost 30 years.
Yeah, we're going to be spoiling this, but I also feel like this is a movie that maybe has flown past people's radars that you know, deserves a first watch. And
good point.
Yeah.
Good point.
I will show restraint. Well, this is the kind of movie where you know what's going to happen. It's more about how it unfolds.
Right. And yeah. I will be considering that statements moving forward. But you have this character who's obsessed with media. Naturally, and this is in the 90s, and she's got her camcorder. So you've got that, and she's filming even when she has them over for the party, James and Liddy.
Yeah.
And she's filming them. Then you've got the local public access TV station where she does her news program, and then she's also making her own documentary.
Right.
Are there any, I mean, like, there's also like all the news cameras once like the story gets out, and there's such wonderful things done with that. There's some wonderful scenes like that. You know, there's one scene I'm thinking of particularly when she has that moment and she sees the lights from the news trucks and the cameras out in front of the house, and she just has this moment where she's drawn to them, and it's like that.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm ready for my close up, Mr. DeMille.
And they totally reference that in the commentary too. That's
and
that
yes,
moment.
I was quoting exactly. Harvey Fierstein, quoting Sons of Bolivar. Just
Harvey Fierstein, yeah, Mrs. Doubtfire.
Not Harvey Fierstein. Harvey Fierstein's not the one who said that. Robin Williams was the one who said
Robin Williams, yeah.
And Mrs. Doubtfire, yes. So you've got that wonderful moment, and it's one of those things that Nicole Kidman just nails so well in
totally.
This. This media obsession, and like, I wouldn't necessarily say that it was like way ahead of its time in the 90s, because we were there, but it's gone so much further.
Well, yes, I think that for this type of story to be coming up in the mid 90s is a great time for it to be coming up, because cameras are becoming more portable and seen more regularly. And this is perhaps more a time when, you know, cable is really booming.
Oh,
and and there's also like bootleg tape trades and things like that. So, is kind of an era before, you know, it's like original viral video type stuff.
Oh, big time. Like, I remember I had, when I was a senior in high school in 94, and I graduated in 95, I got, like, someone obtained for me a VHS copy of Pulp Fiction that was taped from a Japanese laser disc.
No.
But Pulp Fiction was still in theaters here.
Yeah.
And so I had this letterbox VHS of Pulp Fiction, and it just had Japanese subtitles. It was in English. But like, that was the type of thing that you were doing, or you were like, tape trading is big among, we've talked about the pro wrestling fans before, but that was the internet wrestling community who were, you know, going on message, you know, on these boards and saying like, hey, I've got a tape of these like death matches from Japan in 92. And like, who's got this, you know, match from 79 and it is so much more, it was shadier and more interactive and it was so much more exciting, like it's like land that find.
There's the line that's in To Die For where it's like, you know, you're nobody unless you're on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And to be living in a world now where everybody has, I mean, we're doing it right now. We've got cameras in front of our faces and going to be putting this out to anybody in the entire world, minus North Korea and China, who wants to see it. And And that's just like, and we hope that people watch it. And
it's hopefully not, the people in North Korea and China can work out a tape trade or something and get some bootlegs of this great
did
stuff.
Did you get the latest, latest Ruined Childhoods podcast video episode that got dubbed onto VHS?
Oh, with the English subtitles?
Yeah. Just pretend that I said that in Korean. So I think that it's kind of one of those stories that's going to be interesting no matter when you watch it, because you're going to be able to compare it to, you know, the current status of what it means to be seen. Mm-hmm. And I mean, of course, Suzanne Stone is taking it into an extreme length where it's, you know, all that's important to her is becoming famous from being on television. And she also is a little delusional where, yes, this role that she has at this local public access station with Wayne Knight is, you know, it's pretty small potatoes. Like, nobody's really watching it, but the camera's in front of her face, and that's all that matters. You know, her idol is Connie Chung, and she wants to be at that level, but it's not like we know that she's gone to school for journalism or anything. It's just quick ticket to success for her.
Right. Yeah. And it's just about like just going on her ideas and ambition, doing what she needs to do, you know, like convincing her husband to take their honeymoon in Florida where there's a convention happening.
Yeah.
But if I can comment on the timeliness of when this story is being told, and I hope I'm not putting the cart too much in front of the horse here, or the horse in front of the cart. No, never mind. Cart in front of the horse.
Cart before the horse.
Yeah, it's cart before. Boy, sometimes I don't know where the cart is, where the horse is, but I don't know. But I think about like when this story takes place, and I think about like you think about the obsession and how this character is. There's also the mental health aspect that I want to come back to, because there are moments, because there's a lot of ways you could have portrayed this character, and I think that the way that this character was portrayed definitely hints at some mental health issues it being experienced. But I wonder if our Suzanne Stone was in, you know, 15, 20 years later, when we have, you know, things like YouTube, et cetera, and really ways where anybody can be on television, and even like television itself is not necessarily the main thing. And it's not what it's more like your Suzanne Stones of 2024 are like, I want to have like the millions of likes on TikTok. I want to be TikTok famous, or I want to post something that's going to be shared, that's going to be spread around. And I wonder if a Suzanne Stone with a phone and social media accounts and all that, if having that type of access would have been good for her. Just to be able to like channel her energies and think about it, because we live in a world now where if you can use the production software and, you know, you can figure a few things out and you spend a little bit of money, you can create your productions. You can add production value that used to be so restricted to being, you know, part of a network or a studio. And that is like someone like her, I could see her being a YouTuber.
Yeah. I mean, at the very least.
Right. I mean, and potentially, especially with her, the amount of time she wants to put into things.
She hustles.
She
it's
hustles.
Just a matter of how she does it. She's not hustling in the sense of, like we were saying before, going to school for journalism.
Right.
She's hustling in the sense of, how can I do this? You know, how can I get the obstacles out of my way as quickly as possible? But when she does have the opportunity at the television station, she goes in there, guns a-blazing, and she doesn't accept no for an answer. And she states her case in a really strong way that captures their attention. And even though she's not going to be in front of the camera, turns out eventually she will be, but like that's not the initial plan. But during that entire time when she's there, every single day has new ideas for different things that they can be doing at the station, new shows. So she hustles. Yeah.
Right. And with more, you know, means available to her.
Yeah.
She wouldn't need to. She wouldn't need to groom teenagers to kill her husband so that she could be a TV star, because she could just be a TV star and make herself a TV star. And she'd probably put like a lot of attention into the editing and have really good production value. Like the Suzanne Stone YouTube channel would probably be a you know, go-to destination.
I will say, though, when you talk about production value, when we do see the footage that she is capturing and the way that she is capturing footage, it doesn't look good. And she has no knowledge of how to like move while holding a camera or not move.
No, but again, yeah. Like for all of those lessons, she would have to go to journalism school, whereas now there are so many. This is Suzanne Stone would be subscribing to Masterclass. She'd buy Final Cut. Like she would be.
I think that she'd be watching free YouTube videos and figuring it out that way. Or honestly, she'd probably be just finding somebody who knows how to do it, who'd be willing to do it for her. And because that's her nature. She can get what she wants because of the way that she looks and acts. And as we see, she is a master manipulator and has found these three targets when she goes to that high school. And I'd like to talk about them for a few minutes. Should we start with Lydia, played by Allison Folland?
Yes.
Played masterfully. Her? She's so good. She feels so real.
Oh yeah.
And her character, you know, she divulges information that she later realizes like, oh, I should not have said that because she used that against me and found my vulnerabilities. And absolutely amazing.
She's a great character. Wonderful character. And right, like she's played so, I feel like everyone knows that girl.
Sure. Yeah.
I feel like we can all think back and remember back in school, like, yeah, somebody who is, I mean, same for Jimmy and Russell, but
yeah,
more, but especially for Lydia.
Yeah.
So relatable. And it's and the glimpses that you get, like, and when she talks about her home life and
yeah.
And like some of the things that she reveals, and not just what she reveals, but the way she talks about it, it is very touching. And you really, I mean, there are most of the characters in this movie are, you know, sympathetic, you know, at least to an extent, but she is really the, you know, the person in this who maybe you feel for the most. Because what I see in her is she's someone who like no one pays attention to her except for like anyone who's going to make fun of her. And then here is this like perfectly put together. I mean, like, it's no accident that Nicole Kidman was cast in the Stepford Wives movie.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, she arguably does a better job as a Stepford wife in this. Well, actually, yeah. No, she doesn't. She's the opposite of a Stepford
wife. Well, they want her to be a Stepford
wife.
She
plays, yeah. Right, yeah. But, this person who's glamorous and has, like, seemingly just has her shit together is treating Lydia like a human being and is seeing value, showing that, like, hey, there's value in you, even if it's bullshit.
Yeah.
Lydia doesn't realize that, and especially because she's, like, hearing this for the first time. So you really, and especially when you know that she's being manipulated, but you understand why.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. My heart goes out to her.
Sure.
But I think that knowing that Lydia is maybe the most sympathetic character and that the character that the audience is going to feel the most for, I feel like that also kind of speaks to where her character arc ends up.
Sure.
So I feel like that is, I will say, satisfying without saying.
Yeah.
More than I need to, I'd say it is satisfying the way that her character arc ends up.
Yeah. I would argue that all three of the teens, you know, are very sympathetic characters. You know, Russell, Casey Affleck's character, he comes across, he's, you know, a rude, you know, just a total ass. But you understand why when you find out that, like, his father is abusive, his teacher is abusive to him,
yeah.
Played by Buck Henry.
Yeah.
And so you have to give him a little bit of leeway, understanding that, like, he is set up to fail in every direction. And now that there's this opportunity for him to do something, even though he's not getting anything out of it, he's the only one who's really getting nothing out of it, because he doesn't care about Suzanne's friendship or any other type of relationship with her. He's just useful.
Yeah. It's something to do.
And he's good at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought that Casey Affleck was great. I mean, this is, you know, really
his first movie.
I mean, I think he was like a bit role in something else years before. I saw like some credits of his where it was like going way back, but like his first real role. And they said in the commentary that the reason why he went in for this is because Matt Damon was reading for the role of Jimmy and suggested that they meet with Casey for the role of Russell. And they didn't go with Matt Damon for Jimmy because he was too good looking.
Like the last time, maybe not the last time you saw Matt Damon before To Die For, but one of the most recent Matt Damon performances before this would have been School Ties, where he's all, you know, prepped up. And then Courage Under Fire was a few months before this, so where he's in the army.
Yeah. But it was, I think, such an awesome way to bring in Joaquin, like, I guess, freshly dubbed Joaquin Phoenix, his first role as Joaquin Phoenix. He hadn't acted since 89 with Parenthood. And, you know, in the time between Parenthood and this, of course, his brother dies. Mm. And now Joaquin gets to work with this director that his brother worked with on My Own Private Idaho. And it feels like a really poetic choice for them to be working together in this moment.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, looking at his early acting roles as Leaf Phoenix, and then in this role, you're just like, oh, wow. He has transformed into like a real, I mean, he's,
I don't
so
know.
Great.
I feel like this
movies.
Was the natural trajectory for Gary in Parenthood.
I don't know, because at the end of Parenthood, he's, you know, kind of getting.
I mean,
things
this is what
out.
Happens when your dad goes off to have a party and leaves your mom to raise two kids.
Yeah, but he's kind of got that like surrogate father figure in Keanu.
This is true. Yeah. Well, we do get to see him slapping the salami in this one.
Yeah, and that's true. And also, his mom starts seeing his teacher in Parenthood, right?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So good. Oh, anyway, yeah. I feel like Gary had a better chance than Jimmy.
Gary had a better support system.
Absolutely. Yeah, he had the whole Buckman family, the whole crew.
Yeah, as did with the character he played in Space Camp. Also, wonderful support system there.
Max.
Max, thank you. Oh, yeah. Right.
He had Jinx.
Jinx loves Max.
They were friends forever.
Yes, friends forever.
The only way I can remember that his name is Max is because of Max and Jinx, friends forever.
Yes. I mean, look, I don't know where I am tonight. I'm putting horses before carts and whatnot. So
far we're covering the first three movies of Joaquin Phoenix's career, because we did Space Camp, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we did Absolutely. Space Camp, Parenthood. Yeah, yes. Yeah. So Jimmy, what an amazing character. And the moments where we see Jimmy, you know, not even saying anything, but we just see the expression on his face, you know, when they're in the photo booth or when Suzanne is like dancing outside of the car and you just see the look on his face. You're just like, I mean, I saw it and I was just like, who did win like supporting actor? Who was nominated for supporting actor that year? And why was he not in that bunch?
The answer is Kevin Spacey won supporting actor that year for The Usual Suspects.
But who else is nominated?
Who else is not? Like, yeah. Something that I figured we would get to eventually, but like To Die For really doesn't get a lot of awards. I feel like the 19, if you were going to like redo.
No, she won the Golden Globe, but aside from that, it didn't get much love.
No, and I would have to say, like, if you were going to go back to 1 year and like redo the Oscars, 1995 would be an ideal year to go back to. I feel like
totally
with hindsight, so many things would be different. I think To Die For and Seven would get so many more nominations, and not to mention another one, a movie that I actually saw the same weekend I saw To Die For was Strange Days.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, another
Catherine Bigelow. So you remember the first time that you saw To Die For?
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I remembered the exact theater. I'm sure it's no longer around, but I remember. So it was a weekend. It was fall 1995. I was going to college down at Rutgers, and I was spending a weekend up at NYU, hanging out, visiting with definitely my friend Liz from high school.
Oh,
and
cool.
I don't remember if hung out with anyone. And this was before I really was spending a lot of time in New York City. So I didn't necessarily like know a lot of the area as well. And I remember, I forget if it was like she had class or something, but like there were definitely times where I had just time to wander.
Got it.
The village alone. And I definitely had time. I'm almost positive I remember seeing both Strange Days and To Die For in that weekend. Not at the same theater.
Would have been a great double feature.
Yeah. Totally. But I remember seeing it. And I remember like just the image, those close-ups of Nicole Kidman with the white background and like on the big screen. And again, it was something different, something exciting, and something that like you didn't know what was going to happen, where it was going. You know, there were certain things you could tell were happening, but it was such an exciting movie to see, especially at that time, because I remember really feeling like shunning anything that was too, you know, typical or
we were a little snobby in 95.
Yeah, I mean, when I was in acting school, so Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, even like before that, I would say, you know, and I not entirely, like I was still, I definitely still had love in my heart for Hollywood blockbusters.
Yeah.
But I was really excited by like new and interesting things, or just things that I were new to me and mm-hmm. styles of filmmaking, because so much, I mean, so much of the, you know, exciting filmmaking in the 90s was inspired by the exciting filmmaking in the 70s.
Yeah.
So there were like a lot of things I saw them in the 90s that was like, oh my, this is, wow, that's a different way to make a movie. And then it's like, oh yeah, go back and watch this from the 70s.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, a movie like this, like we said, Gus Van Sant takes big swings. This is going to be something that you're not going to have seen really anything else like this at this point. And you're also seeing some of today's like great actors at the beginnings of their careers, you know, Casey Affleck and Joaquin Phoenix, both, you know, best actor Oscar winners now, and continuing, especially Joaquin Phoenix, to put out Academy Award worthy performances like every single year.
Or at least interesting performances.
Oh,
I did not get through much of Napoleon.
Oh, I thought Napoleon was actually pretty great. But Napoleon is also the same year as Bo is Afraid.
Well, yes,
and when you
yes,
and
yes.
when you look at like him as an actor and the things that he is doing and the roles he's taking that are all so different from one another. And, you know, and this year he's going to be in Joker 2.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh my God, how can you do all of these things back to back to back to back? He's a machine.
Well, and he's a machine. He's
much like Jinx in Space Camp.
He's friends forever. They've become one. Yeah. He's an enigma. Like he did that whole thing where he was like quitting the business to become a rapper and made that whole documentary.
Dan, call me crazy, but I loved that.
No, but a lot of people.
I was along for the ride. Well, no, he got a lot of hate for that. So
just because
he
tricked people.
Well,
good opportunity to promote this month's Walt pick, by the way.
Okay, all right. So let's talk quickly about I'm Not There. So, you know, it's this weird mockumentary kind of fake real story about Joaquin Phoenix quitting acting to become a rapper. It was made by him and Casey Affleck, who met and became best friends on To Die For. I mean, Casey Affleck was married for quite a while to Joaquin Phoenix's sister.
Right. Yes.
And so clearly they had a pretty strong bond there. And so, yeah, I remember him going on like Letterman with this like big beard and everything and being a complete wacko and being like transfixed. And I was like, I don't know what is going on, but I love it. At the time I was living in Los Angeles and there were, you know, kind of, you know, I wouldn't call them posters, but kind of like the silhouette image of Joaquin Phoenix plastered all over the place. I wish I would have taken one from like a wall somewhere, but it was so good. And to see what it was just like, much like Gus Van Sant, taking a big swing. And it's not going to work for most people because people are going to get pissed off about it. But I thought that it was fantastic. But yeah, like you were saying, on The Walt, which is my online discussion forum for documentary films, this month's film is called Art of the Prank. And it features this this man, Joey Skaggs, who you may have even seen because he's been putting... Were you familiar with Joey Skaggs before this?
I didn't know I was familiar with Joey Skaggs, but okay. I think there were a couple of the clips, and I'm about halfway through.
Oh, cool.
There were a few clips that I was just like, wait a second. Like I feel like I remember something like this because he did so like many
cat
pranks
for dogs
in the New York area. Yeah, the cat house for dogs, the cockroach guy.
So
portable confessional.
The portable confessional. Yeah, Portafest. So before there was Sacha Baron Cohen, there was Joey Skaggs, who was taking advantage of, you know, news media and poking holes in their systems by going on as these completely made up people talking about things that weren't actually real. And he's been doing this since the 60s. He's still doing it to this day. He just had his, I don't even know how many years he's been doing it, but he does an annual April Fool's Day parade in New York. Mm-hmm. And it's astonishing the things that he's able to get away with and the ways that he continuously manages to trick people. And he and I have been emailing. We talked on the phone once, and we're going to have we're going to record a little conversation at some point soon. But yeah, he hustles, man. Yeah.
You have to, if you're going to make a living, if that's what you're going to devote your life to, is like, yeah, you have to hustle. And you, it's interesting seeing him in the film putting together some of the pranks.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And hearing his reasoning, yeah, and justifications.
Really. Sure. Well, he is an artist and an activist first and foremost. And right, it's just that pranks are his medium.
Right.
And everything is being done for a reason. You know, climate change, GMOs, you name it. He's trying to find ways to, you know, poke holes in the media's portrayal of all these things. And so, right, yeah, subscribe today for free, thewalt.substack.com. There will be a link in, yeah, this episode's description. But moving back to, well,
and
to
speaking
die for,
of, yeah, the media, yeah, and the a media film that very, yeah, much about the media and the, I guess the dangers, the monsters the media can create. Yeah. In, yeah, this, you know, we haven't talked about perhaps my favorite performance in the movie. I love, and I love Nicole Kidman. There's,
can I guess?
Yeah, you can guess.
Ileana Douglas?
Hell yes.
She's so good.
Ileana Douglas in this movie, like, I walked out of this movie definitely being like Oscar for Nicole Kidman, but I was also like, Ileana Douglas, and I recognized her. I knew her from Cape Fear and, yeah, and Goodfellas. I think primarily Cape Fear was what I remembered her from. She plays the lawyer that Nick Nolte's character is like,
right,
kind of having an affair, not really having an affair with, but yeah, but she is so good as Matt Dillon's sister in this, yeah, who is the ice skating
Janice.
The introduction, her introduction is so great when she's skating towards the camera and then falls. And I love that the movie has those moments like that.
What this movie does great with her character, yes, moments like that. There's also the moment where she's just like on the phone and she's like stretching and she's like got an ice skate on and stuff. Mm-hmm. You cut over to a shot where there's like a woman in the bathroom. So without even telling you anything, it's like, okay, well, she's in a same-sex relationship. It's not germane at all to the plot. The relationship that she has with her brother is amazing. Actually, and this is something else I learned from the commentary track, Buck Henry did not like Ileana Douglas and wanted all of her scenes really to be cut. And I'm so glad that he didn't win that fight because they add so much to it. You really need that person, the skeptic, well, you know, that voice to be heard.
Her voice, and she's very, very blunt.
Yeah.
But she's a great counter to Suzanne's sister. Who also
Suzanne's sister? Well, you don't really hear much from her.
No, but and I'm interested. Like, was she mentioned at all in the commentary? Because I feel like there's so much going on when you see her, and she, yeah, doesn't say anything. But it's just like, oh man, she really looks like she can't stand her sister.
Well, yeah, and I wonder what the story is there. If just moments and scenes were cut, because it does, I think, say a lot that she isn't saying much at all, because, you know, her sister is the one who takes up all of the air in the room. You, right, know, it's like she's never going to be able to get a word in if her sister is the subject. So,
and there's also some portrayal of like the cultural differences between the Morettos.
Yeah.
I keep trying to not say Toretto, but between the Morettos and the Stones, the, you know, basically ethnic versus non-ethnic, And
Waspy.
The Waspy, yeah. You definitely get, like, there's some of the things that Kurtwood Smith as Suzanne's father says so on the talk show, and that Dan Hedaya is
like, well, yeah, he alludes, like, well, I don't know, but they could be connected to the mafia.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just like stereotype, but as we find out.
Well, yeah. Yeah. We get a cameo from another great director.
Yeah, David Cronenberg. What an awesome surprise.
What a great cameo.
And such a perfect person to play that role.
So yeah, so I didn't know if having Suzanne's sister be pretty much silent and just kind of having that look of like, why am I here? Versus Janice, who's going to come out and say everything that she has to say.
Yeah. Well, the story coming from her perspective adds a lot to it. And perhaps a story coming from Suzanne's sister's perspective doesn't have a lot of weight to it. I mean, just knowing from Suzanne's dad that from a very young age, she was obsessed with being on TV. They show that one little, clip from the past of her, with a video camera on her and her being on TV. Yeah. And it's like, maybe that's enough. Maybe you don't want to give too much. Maybe you don't want to have her sister saying like, there were always things about her that, bumped me or,
Right. No. I agree. I like that choice, and it just makes me more interested in that character.
Yeah. I don't want to take up too much more time, but I, before we get on to talking about what we would do with this movie, but let's just kind of give a little three cheers for these actors. So Wayne Knight, who's just absolutely amazing. I mean, Wayne Knight, what a great run, aside from being an amazing character in Seinfeld, but like Basic Instinct, Jurassic Park, To Die For,
JFK.
JFK. He's just like, he's there, the 90s, he did his thing, he made his money, and I'm glad for it because he's just awesome in all those roles. Kurtwood Smith, who you mentioned, who continues to be amazing, but Clarence Boddicker is really
iconic. Well, I mean, also you look at the mid-90s satire with Kurtwood Smith. There's a double feature, To Die For and Citizen Ruth.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, hell, throw in RoboCop for good measure. Certainly satirical.
Satire.
But actually, going back to the that early 90s run of Wayne Knight, who was it that you mentioned? You mentioned, so it was Jurassic Park. He's
Basic Instinct.
Basic Instinct. Yeah. Which, all right, so here's, and I know that we're giving some shout outs to actors, but since you mentioned Basic Instinct, I feel like I remember at the time when this movie came out, especially when it was being promoted, the idea that the character, that she was this blonde, icy seductress, and that her name was Suzanne Stone, I always took it to be that it was a reference to Sharon Stone, that like almost this would be a Sharon Stone character. And then I thought about, well, when was the novel written? Novel's published in 92, which is when Basic Instinct comes out. So, and I didn't look into the novel, so I don't know if the character has the same name in the novel.
I don't know. I think maybe. So the novel is written by Joyce Maynard, who plays an attorney in
Suzanne's lawyer, yeah.
Yeah, who you see at the very end, which is fun. It's a fun little cameo. And when I looked at the picture, and you remember the name of the actual person who this is based on, I'm blanking on their name.
Oh, Pamela Smart. Yeah.
Pamela Smart. But when you look at the picture of like the teens that were involved, they've got the same type of like haircuts and the gutter punk looks that Jimmy and Russell have. And it's just done so masterfully. I love it. Shout out to Michael Rispoli, who plays one of the cops. Yes. Spinner Dunn from Death to Smoochie, who we love. Holland Taylor is Suzanne's mom, who's so good. I recently saw her in an episode of Murder, She Wrote. We love Holland Taylor, still to this day, killing
She's
it.
She's great.
Yeah, Maria Tucci, who plays Larry's mom. You know, she's not the most like recognizable actress, at least for me, but the way that she portrays this character, I think, is really good. You know, there are certain moments where it just cuts to her for like a look, and it's extremely effective. Otherwise, I feel like the cast, you know, we talked about Buck Henry a little bit. He plays the teacher that's in the high school class where Suzanne comes in and, you know, meets the teens. And he's fantastic. Dan, do you have any favorite Buck Henry films, whether it be as a writer or actor or both?
The Graduate.
Fair.
I have to go with, honestly, I can't remember off the, and so sorry if anyone's watching the video, just got like close-ups of my chest. I didn't realize, but the plug on the tablet I'm recording on had come out, and all of a sudden I was getting this notification that it was about to die. So,
good save.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what was going on here. And so I'm sorry, you were saying.
What's about Buck Henry?
Yes.
So you're saying The Graduate.
Yeah, I'm blanking on anything else that he did, other than
I'll tell you one of my favorites is Heaven Can Wait.
Yes.
And To Die For, I think, is my number one, but Heaven Can Wait might be number two for me. I actually have a note in my phone. I don't even remember when I wrote down this note, but in the movie Heaven Can Wait, Warren Beatty's character, it says that he is supposed to die on March 25th, 2025. So if Warren Beatty, happens to him March 25th, 2025, wouldn't that be interesting? That's all I'm going to say. Yeah. But holy I have like shit. A thing in my phone that's like a little reminder about it on like March 25th, 2025. And it's like, look out for Warren Beatty. But Buck Henry, he's great in that one. You know, pour one out, Buck Henry. You certainly provided us with some pretty quality content during your career. Mm-hmm. Dan, there's one other thing that I wanted to mention, because you talked about how, you know, the storyline of, you know, woman convinces young person to like kill her husband. Dan, what movie came out a few years before this that had that exact same situation going on?
Wait, that I was I'm still looking up the original name of Suzanne. If it was Susan,
don't even novel. We're past that.
All right, I'm back. I'm locked
in.
Okay.
So, all right, Dan, picture in your head, there is an attractive blonde woman who befriends a younger kind of gutter punk, we'll say teen. They get into a romantic relationship and she tries to convince him to kill her husband. What am I describing?
Oh, give me a moment to think. Edit out the think time. Make it sound like
I'm not going to. Do you want me to, while you're thinking, do you want me to give you some hints?
Is it in the 90s? Is it in?
It is early 90s.
Okay. All right. So we have.
So it's before To Die For. Attractive. I'd say less gutter punk and more metal. I'd say more metalhead
and more metalhead. Okay.
All right, Dan. Name some hot blonde actresses of the early 90s.
Patricia, are we talking about True Romance?
No, we're not.
No. Hot blonde actresses of the early 90s. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Nicole Kidman, Sharon Stone, Patricia Arquette. Nicole Kidman.
No.
Kim Basinger? Kim Basinger where she convinces someone to kill her? Is it the marrying man?
No. Wayne's World 2.
Oh, Wayne's World 2. Oh my God. I wasn't even thinking along those. Okay. Yeah,
but you know exactly what I'm talking about. I want to do a super cut of the scene where Kim Basinger is talking Garth into killing her husband with the scene in the motel room where or maybe a couple of the scenes, but where Suzanne is trying to tell Jimmy to kill her husband, because I bet that you can mix the two of them up in a lot of different ways and they come out exactly the same. But there you go.
I would like to, I'm in favor of that supercut.
He's a dead man.
You, John, are a Wayne's World 2 scholar. Like,
is that my legacy?
Yes. You are, like, there are a few people that are not named Dana Carvey or Mike Myers that I would go to for information about Wayne's World. And I've seen the movie.
Also, if you text me, you know I'll text back.
This is true. Yeah. Yeah. Mike Myers will not return my texts to any of his characters.
No.
Yeah. No.
So
I've texted them all.
So Dan, we are 34 years after To Die For. Is that where we are?
Well, it's not quite, because that was 1995. So it is 34 years.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what would you do all these years later with To Die For?
A musical.
Okay.
Because honestly, I think that and we talked earlier about the kind of psychiatric aspect of Suzanne Stone's character. And it says on Wikipedia that she would have been diagnosed as having narcissistic personality disorder, which makes sense. I do think that I think that musicals do play into stories where you are going in and out of a character's mind and seeing the way that they see things, going kind of back and forth from that. So, I mean, not to mention the fact that musicals based on movies are, you know.
By the way, 29 years, not 34 years.
29 years. Okay, yeah. You see, I would ask you questions about Wayne's World 2, but nobody should ask either of us any questions about math,
clearly. That's true. All right, go on, musical.
So, yeah, I think a musical would be great. You could have, you know, it doesn't necessarily rely on any fancy settings. There's very little that you couldn't do or adapt to a musical. I think a lot of the characters are very, like, they kind of play into the character types that you have in a musical.
Mm-hmm.
And where you have a lot of, like, the contradictions, like the Morettos and the Stones, mm-hmm. and Janice, and was it Suzanne's sister? Was it Faye? I think.
Yes.
I don't know if I'm just making it. Yeah.
Yes. You're right. Yeah.
So you've got that contradiction. You've got the kids who I'm like imagining some great, like, you know, three part harmony songs with them. You can almost parody, like, Merrily We Roll Along with Jimmy Russell and Lydia. And I think it would play into, you know, you're already breaking the fourth wall in the movie. So on stage, adapting that, bringing that that aspect into it, I really think it would play well for stage. I feel like on as a musical, it's open for more people to kind of take ownership of the roles, especially Suzanne, and it having been now 29 years.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like it's time. It's not like there aren't actresses that I couldn't see doing this in, you know, in just like a straight up remake. Like Emma Stone would probably, name coincidence aside, like would probably be wonderful. You know, there are so many actresses. Margot Robbie would be
That's
probably
a pretty obvious choice. Yeah.
But it's such a, this movie is like, for all the reasons we've talked about, as a film, it's so like, it's kind of in its best form.
Oh yeah. No, it works great.
So yeah. It's not something where I feel like, oh, there's something more you could do with this, or like, oh, if you said it today, because honestly, I think if you said it today, realistically, you might not have the same.
No, setting it in the early to mid 90s is kind of perfect.
It's perfect. It's perfect. Yeah. So like, that's where I would go with it, is a musical, and I actually think it would be really good. What do you think, John?
First of all, I would see it for sure. I wouldn't go for musical, but I think that's just my own sensibilities and preferences. I am not particularly drawn to musicals. I think that typically the music in them just isn't really my style. But I do feel like this story and the way that that the film constructs it could translate really well to the stage. I just don't think that a musical would be my preference for the way things go. But like some sort of mixed media stage presentation where anything that, you know, would exist on, you know, the camera that would be used in the show itself, you know, those types of things could be projected onto a screen, where it's of the interview footage, the television show footage. Even if you're doing the classroom scenes, it could still be from the perspective of Suzanne's camera, the way that we see it when we cut to the scene where, you know, it's the one that they used in all the news stuff where they're talking about like the AIDS crisis and she's saying like, you know, and he's like, not well with my current sexual situation, worried because it's so good. And also the way that it pans over quickly to Casey Affleck and the look that he gives, that's brilliant. Like that stuff works so well, and you can do all that classroom stuff through the perspective of the lens, like through the lens.
Right. Yeah. And that's something that's been, I remember, you know, they used that for the Who's Tommy originally on Broadway, actually right around the same time with now the Who's Tommy is back on Broadway.
And, is it?
Yeah. I've heard it's a wonderful revival. I would love to see it. That's one of my favorite shows. So, another reason, if I can jump back into the musical thing, because I definitely considered like, musical or stage play, but something else that keeps this, this movie has a solid momentum to it and a really strong pace because of the editing.
Yeah.
Also the score, Danny Elfman's score.
Let's talk about the score for a second. So real quick, that's my idea. You know, I don't think that there's much else really to mine there. One of the things that I think that I would have suggested a few months ago if we were covering this movie would be a proper, like, cool Blu-ray release with an amazing commentary track. And Criterion did that, like, a week ago. So I was very happy to make that purchase for that Blu-ray. But yes, talking about the score, you know, Dan, one of my favorite memories for To Die For is when we used this score for a summer camp that you were leading for young filmmakers.
That's like, right. Yes.
12-year-old filmmakers. Yeah. And when we were kind of going through and being like, well, what can we use for the music for this? And we had a Danny Elfman score CD or something like that. And
well, I had the Danny Elfman compilation. So Music from a Darkened Theater, I had that. And then they put out a second volume, Music from a Darkened Theater. And that had the To Die For music on it. And it's really interesting because it shifts so much from like the your it starts with your typical like dun 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 and then just goes into like shredding electric guitars.
So when I was watching it just this past week, I didn't love the score as much, and I do wonder if. I mean, clearly the movie is amazing and I love it and the score does what the score needs to do, but there were certain things about it that felt to me like, I think that the Danny Elfman of it all stood out more in this past viewing, where it didn't quite fit for me in the same way that perhaps, I don't know, different type of music would fit in, because it felt more like Edward Scissorhands to me. And, you know, it just has the Elfman DNA all over it. And it feels more like a Tim Burton score for Elfman than anything else. So
I definitely have mixed feelings about the score. I think watching it on the most recent pass, I saw how it fits.
Yeah.
Because I always felt like, okay, it's kind of like Danny Elfman sat down to start writing the music and then like looked back at what he wrote and said, oh, I wanted to do something different for this. But instead of erasing what he did, he just added something else and then found it. Oh, I'm back at doing Danny Elfman stuff. Let me guitars.
I think that it feels a little too literal for me.
That it's literally going back and forth between
it's,
I guess
too on the nose.
That was kind of what I saw in it. And it also, like, there is the kind of quirk factor. Like, this movie does have its quirks, which it really does pull off this impressive balancing act of humor and the aspects of a thriller.
Yeah.
The really sharp satire. But also just like, yeah, some silly humor like Janice falling on the ice.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So one other thing that I wanted to bring up that they talked about in the commentary track, and then we can wrap things up. You know, the Joaquin Phoenix doc, the interview footage is all when he is in prison. And it's so good. It's so good. And they're saying that
he looks creepy in that. And I'm sorry to interrupt with this, and I'm going to shut up. But so I directed a stage production of The Laramie Project, and doing research was, you know, looked at a lot of pictures of Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson, the two guys who killed Matthew Shepard.
Yeah.
And Joaquin Phoenix in the prison scenes looks so much like one of them. Not like, oh, he looks like they made him to look like him, but like the short hair.
Yeah.
And the shirt, and it, like, yeah, I love it's so it's uneasy.
Yeah. His performance also is just masterful. He's so good. But you know, the way that they shot that was on a soundstage, and they had built out just kind of like a square essentially for this. And there's one shot where it like pulls back and it even feels like you're just kind of in a little like cube of a place, whatever. And so the way that was shot was just like, you know, constructed within a soundstage. It had three walls and the ceiling and everything. And there are just all the lights going in. And so he couldn't really see anybody. You know, he just saw the camera lens, but he couldn't really see the people that were behind the camera. And at a certain point when he was kind of getting ready for shooting, he was just kind of in there prepping and stuff. And he was like, I don't know if anybody's back there. Because he was like waiting for a while. And then he went back and there was nobody there. And then he walked until he found a room where everybody was in there, huddled around a TV, watching the OJ chase.
No shit.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think I heard that story sounds familiar. Yeah. I might have read that at some point.
Yeah, I thought that's so fantastic. What a fascinating time that must have been for
him. Sign of the Times. Yeah. Was that June 1994? We're almost at the 30th anniversary of that.
Yeah.
I remember it happened not long after Naked Gun 33 and a third came out in the theater.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
So.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I could talk about this movie for hours longer, but for us, it is very late, so we won't do that. But Dan, why don't you tell everybody what we're going to be covering on our next episode?
Our next episode is going to be a very special episode of the Rudin Childhoods podcast, Road Trip Edition, because we're going home. We're going to New Jersey. We're going.
Yeah.
No, we're going back from where we are. We're nowhere. We're the boys from nowhere. We're in the Pacific Northwest now, but we are.
Yeah.
The motherland is New Jersey. And we will at least be visiting New Jersey cinematically by way of Minnesota.
For the most part, a teeny bit of New Jersey.
We'll get into that because it is favorite moment of mine in that movie. We're going to be talking about Mallrats, Kevin Smith's second feature.
Decided upon by our online audience on social media.
Yes. And thank you all for your suggestions.
The TikTok voters, they showed up.
Yeah. And Mallrats, I can't say it's a decision that we are unhappy about. So,
we'll talk about that.
I mean, we've got Jason London in this, Claire Forlani, Michael Rooker, the aforementioned Ben Affleck, Joey Lauren Adams, Jason Lee, Jason Mewes, Kevin Smith, the whole part. Who am I
Ethan
forgetting?
Ethan Suplee.
Ethan Suplee, Dante from Clerks shows up. It's Brian O'Halloran.
Yeah. Brian O'Halloran.
And
Stan Lee.
The late, great Stan Lee. Yes. Yeah. So,
stacked cast.
Certainly a fun one to talk about. And a.
Of the same year as To Die For.
Yeah. Same time, in fact. I want to say they both came out in October 95.
Oh, interesting. We'll have to find some marquee photos or some newspaper clippings where the two of those are advertised.
It's tremendous, but hey, it's great. You know, yeah, we're going to party like it's 1995.
Still.
And check out Mallrats. Shannon Doherty. That's, I'm like, I'm
Shannon Doherty, wow.
I'm like, I'm forgetting somebody in this movie.
I guess I just assumed that you said Shannon Doherty at the very beginning. Do you say Joey Lauren Adams? who else do we got in there?
I think I said pretty much everybody.
Did you say Ben Affleck?
I said Ben Affleck. You know who I didn't? I'm forgetting her name. She was on Three's Company. But anyway, we'll get to it. It's not Suzanne Summers. She played Terry on Three's Company and she's the psychic in Mallrats. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mallrats, 1995, Kevin Smith. On our next episode, we're going to Jersey, baby. Fist pumps, Bon Jovi. Springsteen, Thunder Road.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God.
New Jersey things. Yeah.
Well, Dan, as you are ice skating on top of, I don't even want to finish that sentence, but I wish you a good journey.
Good journey.